spoken word content. It's a great station.
CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Vancouver, British Columbia, on unceded Coast Salish, Musqueam Territory. Learn how to get involved at citr.ca.
You are tuned in to a very special edition of Intersections produced by CITR's Gender Empowerment Collective. It is 24 hours of student power. We are entering yet another hour of power, and students in this particular hour is all about intersectional feminism. The Gender Empowerment Collective is a fantastic group of volunteers here at CITR, and we produce a weekly radio program every Tuesday from 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. here on CITR 101.9 FM. And online at citr.ca. And we produce local current affairs content about intersectional feminist topics. It's pretty exciting. It's pretty great. And as always, we are broadcasting from the unceded Coast Salish Musqueam Territory here at the beautiful UBC campus. And today, for 24 hours of student power, we have a very special show compiling some of our greatest hits, if you will. We'll be looking back at three interviews that we've produced over the last year that were produced by UBC students about UBC students doing really cool, exciting, important things. And we're going to listen to one of those right now to kick off the show. And it actually just aired on our program this week. This is produced by stellar UBC student Hannah Toms, who is participating in the Vagina Monologues this weekend. And so she sat down with some of her fellow participants to talk about the monologues, their experiences, and do a few readings from them. And they'll also have some information about where you can catch the show tonight and tomorrow night here. So that is pretty exciting, and we're going to listen to that one right now here on Intersections. It's Student Power. Huzzah!
My vagina's angry. It is. It's pissed off. My vagina's furious and it needs to talk. It needs to talk about all this shit. It needs to talk to you. I mean, what's the deal? An army of people out there thinking up ways to torture my poor ass, gentle, loving vagina, spending their days constructing psycho products and nasty ideas to undermine my pussy. Vagina motherfuckers. All this shit they're constantly trying to shove up us, clean us up, stuff us up, make it go away? Well, my vagina's not going away. It's pissed off and it's staying right here. Like tampons. What the hell is that? A wad of dry fucking cotton stuffed up there. Why can't they find a way to subtly lubricate the tampon? As soon as my vagina sees it, it goes into shock. It says forget it. It closes up. You need to work with the vagina, introduce it to things, prepare the way. That's what foreplay's all about. You've got to convince my vagina, seduce my vagina, engage my vagina's trust. You can't do that with a dry wad of fucking cotton.
Hello, we are five members of the cast and crew of UBC's production of The Vagina Monologues 2018. My name is Hannah Toms. I'm a cast member performing in Introduction, Lists, and They Beat the Girl Out of My Boy.
I am Mickey, and I am performing the Vagina Workshop in The Vagina Monologues.
I'm Zainab, and my monologue is Reclaiming C-U-N-T.
I'm Nicole, and I'm the stage manager.
I'm Michaela Gerwing, and I'm the director. So for those of you that don't know, The Vagina Monologues is a play written by Eve Ensler in the 90s, and it's performed globally every year around Valentine's Day to raise awareness and to help end violence against women. So we're going to give you a sneak peek of our show that's happening on February 17th and 18th in the Frederick Wood Theater at 7 o'clock. Doors open at 6. Tickets are available online or at the door. We're going to give you a little taste of our show with Mickey performing part of our piece, Vagina Workshop.
In the first session, the woman who runs the Vagina Workshop asked us to draw a picture of our own unique, beautiful, fabulous vagina. That's what she called it. She wanted to know what our own unique, beautiful, fabulous vagina looked like to us. One woman who was pregnant drew a big red mouth, screaming with coins spilling out. Another very skinny woman drew a big serving plate with a kind of Devonshire pattern on it. I drew a huge black dot with little squiggly lines around it. The black dot was equal to a black hole in space, and the squiggly lines were meant to be people or things or just your basic atoms that got lost there. I had always thought of my vagina as an anatomical vacuum, randomly sucking up particles and objects from the surrounding environment. I did not think of my vagina in practical or biological terms. I did not, for example, see it as something attached to me. In the workshop, we were asked to look at our vaginas with hand mirrors. Then, after careful examination, we were to verbally report to the group what we saw. I must tell you that, up until this point, everything I knew about my vagina was based on hearsay or invention. I had never really seen the thing. It had never occurred to me to look at it. My vagina existed for me on some abstract plane. It seemed so reductive and awkward looking at it, like we were in the workshop on our shiny blue mats with our hand mirrors. It reminded me of how the early astronomers must have felt with their primitive telescopes. I found it quite unsettling at first, my vagina. Like the first time you see a fish cut open and you discover this other bloody complex world inside, right under the skin. It was so raw, so red, so fresh. And the thing that surprised me most was all the layers. Layers inside layers, opening into more layers. My vagina amazed me. I couldn't speak when it came my turn in the workshop. I was speechless. I had awakened to what the woman who ran the workshop called vaginal wonder. I just wanted to lay there on my mat, legs spread, examining my vagina forever.
So now we're going to move on to a discussion between the five of us, and the theme around which our discussion is going to revolve is a very large concept in third wave feminism, which is intersectionality. And Zainab is going to read us a definition of the word intersectionality.
So this definition is from YW Boston. Intersectionality was coined by law professor and social theorist Kimberly Crenshaw. And basically, intersectional theory asserts that people are often disadvantaged by multiple sources of oppression, such as race, class, gender identity, sexual orientation, religion, and others. And intersectionality recognizes that these identity markers do not exist independently of each other, and that each informs the others, often creating a complex convergence of oppression.
So, The Vagina Monologues was written by Eve Ensler during the 1960s, the 1970s?
The
90s. The 90s. Okay, I thought it was much earlier than that. But in the 90s, that still would have been part of second wave feminism. And something that second wave feminism, as much as it was an incredible and important movement, something that's being criticized about it today, now that we're in third wave feminism, is that it was very much a white and cis movement. And relating to the definition that Zainab just read, third wave feminism is intersectional feminism, and it draws on not just the perspective of privileged women. And something we're going to talk about is that the Vagina Monologues itself has been heavily criticized for being quite exclusive toward especially the trans community.
Vagina Monologues in itself is criticized because we use the word vagina, what we now recognize as part of third wave feminism, that vagina isn't synonymous with being a woman. You don't have to have a vagina to be a woman. And I think that's a big part of why the Vagina Monologues has been criticized so much. But even so, it is still an important piece to keep doing on a year-by-year basis.
What's great about the Vagina Monologues is that Eve Ensler brings new works to the play. So hopefully, I'm hoping that the Vagina Monologues will start to evolve over the years and to include those different identities and also include more discussion in regards to the openness in defining what a woman can be.
While there are some pieces with issues in the show, there are also a lot of pieces that remain very relevant to today. So while we are in a different wave of feminism and have different definitions of what a woman is and what a feminist is, a lot of things and a lot of issues that we're still dealing with are the same. Sexual violence is still a major issue in our society. The show draws a light on that, and I think it's very important that the show continues to happen, that we continue to have these discussions, like this discussion we're having here about intersectionality and the problems with the show, so that we can take the good parts and leave what's maybe problematic.
And that's a beautiful thing about theater. We're offering a discussion. We're opening the stage up to you and asking you to leave and reflect on what you've seen. Not only are we asking you to reflect, but to bring people who you believe need that reflection and need to open up to this new wave of feminism. We'll be hosting, Mikayla will be hosting, talkbacks after each of our shows on the 17th and 18th to further discuss and answer any questions you have about anything you see on our stage.
As a woman of color, I recognize the importance of promoting inclusivity and a more intersectional feminism so that we can include all women. And I'm hoping that during the talk back discussion portion at the end of the play, we'll have some good discussion around any issues with the play and promoting a more inclusive, intersectional form of feminism.
What's really cool about our production is that we have a Women's March theme going on. So where the play itself may be lacking intersectional recognition, we're incorporating a lot of posters in our Women's March segments that address intersectionality, which is really cool.
Yeah, and we also gave the opportunity to all the cast to discuss a lot of different elements in this. We have a director. She's been amazing at acknowledging that we're a diverse group who needs to all equally have our voice heard. We're incorporating many chants within the transitions that are acknowledging all the things we've been speaking about in this interview.
Yeah, and we spent a lot of time actually talking about those chants. They weren't just kind of picked. A lot of thought was put into them about the different perspectives of the different people who are going to be hearing these chants and different ways that they might be interpreted by people, and making sure that they're inclusive and inoffensive to anyone who might hear them. For example, one of the chants that we came up with for one of the transitions and that's been really popular at women's marches is "Pussy Grabs Back," kind of in response to Donald Trump's "Grab Her by the Pussy." But then we ended up actually taking it out of the transitions because "Pussy Grabs Back" kind of implies a violent gesture, like grabbing sounds violent and almost has kind of a sexual violent connotation.
Yeah, almost like you're going to degrade us or we're going to degrade you right back. And mm-hmm. That's not what we're doing here. We're not trying to objectify the opposite sex because they're objectifying us.
I mean, what we're trying to do is, you know, recognize that we can all have equality. To give some more rights is not going to take anything away from another person.
I think it's something that's very misinterpreted about feminism, and something that drives a lot of men off feminism is that it's perceived as trying to like reverse the balance of power that we have in this patriarchal society that we live in to make women superior in society's eyes to men, which is not, and really not what feminism is about. Feminism is about promoting equality across all gender identities.
I think another important thing to mention is equality versus equity, and something intersectionality is fighting for is equity, because equality is when you're just evening the playing field, like giving women more opportunities, but equity is when we're recognizing every intersection and we're recognizing that people of color have less opportunities, and that indigenous people and indigenous women in particular in this country are really struggling and are facing much more barriers than I am as a cis white woman. And I think that striving to create equity is what we're really doing here with this piece.
In our rehearsals, we have quite a lot of workshops, and it kind of makes me sad almost that audience members who come and see our show only see the show. They don't see everything, all the activities that go on behind the scenes, like during our rehearsals and all the discussions that I've learned so much. Like, my horizons have been so opened by these workshops. But one that we did, I think it was during the first ever rehearsal, we did what's called a privilege walk. Do you maybe want to explain this one, Michaela?
Yeah, I'll explain this one. So when I'm planning rehearsals, I try and do a mix of workshops that have to do with feminism and equity and intersectionality, and also acting workshops. So in our very first rehearsal, we did a privilege walk. I had all the women line up in the room, and then I asked a series of questions and had people take a step forward or take a step back if they had experienced that. So some of the questions would be, have you ever skipped a meal because you couldn't afford one? Did you ever feel like you struggled to go to school because you couldn't afford it? All these different things, not necessarily just money, but just a range of questions that took into account different intersections of identity. And then at the end of the walk, the women took a look around the room and saw where they were in relation to everyone else. And I think that was a really powerful experience for a lot of the people, because I think it's easy to forget our privilege in life. And I think it's easy to forget how privileged we are, and that other people around us, we don't even know, but people have all different struggles. And I think it's important to really recognize our own privilege.
What was really incredible that Alex, our president, who unfortunately isn't here to chat about, noticed by watching everyone do so. And it was really sad to notice the one thing we did all have in common was, even today, we all felt like at one point in our life, we had been discriminated against because we're a woman, because of our identity. We have built this amazing community, and that's exactly what we're trying to work against.
I have learned so much in this experience. We have so many different individuals in our cast with different races, sexuality, and gender expressions, and different religions, and people from all different walks of life. And throughout this experience, we have all learned so much about intersectionality. And this production is so special because we're able to kind of share what we have learned with the audience and get everybody talking about what can still be done, and get people to maybe think a bit more about how intersectionality affects them and the people around them, because it is so important.
This year's production does incorporate things that haven't been incorporated before at UBC V-Day. So even if you've seen the vagina monologues in a past year, what we're doing here this year is different, and there is new things and there's new conversations to be had. So even if you've seen this production before, don't let that discourage you from coming, because there's still so much that you can take away from this show.
And if you haven't seen it too, I'm not just saying this because I'm in the play and I'm promoting. Well, that's that's why we're here, but that's not the only reason I want people to come, because being in the show, I've seen every monologue more times than I can count at this point, but every single time I see each one, I'm so moved and so inspired. Like, there's such a strong, inspiring, sometimes funny, sometimes sad, sometimes sexy message between every single monologue, and I really want people to experience that. There's so much that people who are already hardcore feminists can get out of this play. There's so many people who, you know, haven't been exposed to feminism before can get out of this play. There's so many people who are against feminism, who unfortunately exist, can get out of this play, and hopefully have their minds changed about gender equality. And on that note, I think we're going to wrap it up.
I just want to give a reminder. Our show dates are February 17th and 18th in the Frederick Wood Theater. Our social media, Facebook and Instagram, you can find us at UBC V-Day. Tickets are available online and at the door. Doors open at 6 and the shows are at 7, February 17th and 18th in the Frederick Wood Theater. All proceeds are going to be donated to SASC, the Sexual Assault Support Center on campus, and the Battered Women's Shelter in Vancouver.
This is how I came to love my vagina. It's embarrassing because it's not politically correct. I mean, I know it should have happened in the bath with salt grains from the Dead Sea, Enya playing and me loving my woman self. I know the story. Vaginas are beautiful. Our self-hatred is only the internalized repression and hatred of the patriarchal culture. It isn't real. Pussies unite. I know all of it. Like, if we'd grown up in a culture where we were taught that fat thighs were beautiful, we'd all be pounding back milkshakes and Krispy Kremes, laying on our backs, spending our days thigh expanding. But we didn't grow up in that culture. I hated my thighs, and I hated my vagina even more. I thought it was incredibly ugly. I was one of those women who had looked at it, and from that moment on, I wished I hadn't. It made me sick. I pitied anyone who had to go down there. In order to survive, I started to pretend there was something else between my legs. I imagined comfy futons with light cotton comforters, little velvet satays, leopard rugs, pretty things, like a silk handkerchief or quilted pot holders or play settings. I grew so accustomed to this that I lost all memory of even having a vagina. Whenever I had sex with a man, I imagined him inside of a mink-lined muffler or a Chinese bowl. Then I met Ben. Ben was the most ordinary man I had ever met. He was thin and tall and nondescript and wore khaki tan clothes. He didn't like spicy foods or listen to Prince. He had no interest in sexy lingerie. In the summer, he spent his time in the shade. He didn't share his inner feelings. He didn't have any problems or issues. And he wasn't even an alcoholic. He wasn't very funny or articulate or mysterious. He wasn't mean or unavailable. He wasn't self-absorbed or charismatic. He didn't drive fast. I mean, I didn't particularly like Ben. I mean, I would have missed him altogether if he hadn't picked up the change that I dropped on the deli floor. But when he handed me back my quarters and pennies, and his hand accidentally touched mine, something happened.
Lincoln Alexander was a Black Canadian who achieved much in politics. The child of Jamaican immigrants, he served in the Royal Canadian Air Force during World War II. He graduated from the Osgoode Hall Law School in 1953 and practiced at a number of firms for more than a decade. In 1968, he ran in Canada's federal election in the Hamilton West Electoral District. He won and became Canada's first Black Member of Parliament. He served four consecutive terms before stepping down in 1980. In 1985, he was appointed Lieutenant Governor of Ontario, becoming the first Black Canadian to hold a vice-regal position. Alexander passed away on October 19th, 2012. In December 2013, Lincoln Alexander Day was made a law in Ontario and is held on January 21st. His wife, Marnie Beale Alexander, is currently working to make it a national holiday for Canada. This has been a Black History Month PSA brought to you by CITR.
Member of CITR and Discorder, but are you a true friend?
Get a Friends of CITR and Discorder card for $20 for discounts in Kitsilano and around UBC at
On the Fringe Hair Design, Rufus Guitar Shop, Stormcrow Ale House, The Bike Kitchen, UBC Bookstore, Australia Boot Company, and so many more.
And we are back. You're tuned in to Intersections here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from unceded Coast Salish Musqueam territory here at the beautiful University of British Columbia campus. My name is Mel Woods, this year's Gender Empowerment Collective Coordinator, and I, along with a stellar group of CITR volunteers, produce this program every week, Tuesdays from 2 p.m. to 3 p.m., featuring great interviews, music, all sorts of fun, focusing on intersectional feminism. And today is a very special day because it's not Tuesday, it's Friday. And this is our special 24 Hours of Student Power episode. We are but one of many great campus groups taking over the airwaves today and empowering the student voice, which is great, if you ask me. And for our program today, we're featuring interviews done by students, with students, about students, things like that. We just heard from one of our collective members, Hannah, with information about the Vagina Monologues, which is happening this weekend. And that one originally aired on our program just this week on Tuesday. And next up, we're going to hear one from last semester. This is a great volunteer student named Sam. And after there was some pro-life anti-abortion protesters on campus, she sat down to talk with the Gender, Race, and Social Justice Undergraduate Association about their club, about what they do, as well as about some of the work that they were doing in counter-protesting. So we're going to listen to that conversation right now here on Intersections.
Hey folks, this is Sam from the Gender Empowerment Collective, and I'm here with
Kirsten Tarasoff, and I'm the Treasurer and Arts Undergraduate Society Representative from the Gender, Race, Sexuality, and Social Justice Undergraduate Association.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about what you do?
So what GRSJ Undergrad Association does is basically we serve as the association for the GRSJ degree on campus, and we're open for anyone to join and take part in our events. We work with a lot of intersectional, feminist, academic type things. Our big event occurs at the end of every year, and that's called the F-Word Conference, where we bring together student presenters, workshops, as well as keynote speakers, and it's free for everyone to come to. Throughout the year, we also bring various workshops to campus. Last year, we brought Fat Panic, which talks a lot about body positivity. And we do other kind of smaller events like networking, social justice movie night. My personal favorite was last week. That was Chatting Over Chocolates, where we bring together faculty and people who are interested in social justice with lots of chocolate.
That's great. Always draw on the folks with food.
Oh, 100%.
So you kind of went over it a bit. Your goals in general for the year are programming and getting folks together to have conversations.
Yeah.
Does that sound right?
Yeah, about that. So usually we want to expose people to what does GRSJ actually do and add a face to a lot of the voices you hear about the discussion of social justice, because it's obviously a hot topic right now. So we try to really bring fun events for students to campus and a way for them to learn more while also getting to know other people with the same interests.
That's really great. So as you already mentioned, there's already been a few events going on this year with the GRSJ UA. You mentioned the Chatting Over Chocolates, but one of the other big ones that's happened so far is the counter-protest to the anti-abortion protest. So I'm just wondering, why is this issue so important to you folks?
I think what we all really agree on in social justice is not only the fact that pro-choice and accessibility to abortion should be something that everyone has the right to, but that they should actually have reproductive rights. So things like accessibility to contraceptives, ability to choose what you want to do with your own body. If you choose to have a child, that child should be able to grow up in a safe and respectable environment. So really, when Lifeline comes to campus, we feel like not only do they personally attack people who have maybe had to deal with abortions, right, because that's never an experience anyone wants to have or wants to revisit, but they also kind of skirt around a lot of the issues of, well, how should contraceptives be provided? Should housing be more accessible and affordable for people that want to have children and need a place to raise their children? Other issues such as adoption, you know, they really fail to address the amount of children that are in the foster care system right now and fail to do anything to show that they're pro-life so much as they are anti-choice and really oppressing people into what they should do with their bodies if they do become pregnant.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like the GRSJUA has sort of identified the fact that there might be a few gaps maybe in the conversation, and that's maybe you're trying to fill those gaps by doing a counter-protest?
Yeah, definitely. And with our counter-protest, one of the things we hand out is actually a pamphlet with some mental and sexual health resources. So stuff on campus, like UBC Counseling Services and the Sexual Assault Support Center are a couple on there. But we also have places off of campus like Community, which is for LGBTQ people to go in and get sexual health resources in a place that's safe for them. Or just Vancouver Coastal Health Services, where they can go in, get contraceptives, and hopefully prevent pregnancies that are unwanted before they happen, mm-hmm. so that it's less of a debate and giving everyone accessible health care.
Right. So who do we see on the front lines of this counter-protest? I mean, obviously there's folks from GRSJ who are out there, but I'm wondering, like, is there other than like students outside of GRSJ, those teachers or other community members?
We definitely have other organizations on campus that are really involved with the counter-protest. So as mentioned before, the Sexual Assault Support Center set up a table right near the protest, providing immediate support to anyone who needed it. We also have individual students who just join out of interest and they want to take a stand and be there providing support and showing that they don't want these kind of images on their campus. Another group that has been really involved is the Revolutionary Student Movement. So I know there's been a lot of pictures of the giant red banner up reading No Platform for Hate Speech, and that was their doing. So they've also taken a stand against UBC Lifeline and their Genocide Awareness Project on campus.
Mm-hmm. So there is support from other groups at UBC. I'm wondering, is UBC as an institution engaging with this conversation? Is the AMS engaging with this conversation as they... I mean, they allow it to happen because it's happening, right?
Yeah, so there's actually a long history with the AMS and UBC Lifeline. So Lifeline is an AMS club, and I believe back in 1999, somewhere around that time, Lifeline set up their Genocide Awareness Project, and members of the AMS actually tore it down, and that was taken to court with Lifeline ending up winning that court case. So kind of a complicated history to it, especially because AMS has to not have political opinions in what clubs they allow to be on campus. So there is AMS code and OPSED and stuff like that, which shows how clubs are allowed to act. UBC Lifeline definitely toes the line of that. There's places mm-hmm. where it could be, you know, quite blurry if their methods of protest are acceptable. But AMS itself has not necessarily engaged with Lifeline after losing the court case against them back in the early 2000s.
Right, yeah, it can be tough when there's like kind of all that history going on and trying to be like quote unquote neutral mm-hmm. when that's the body that you're supposed to be, but when there's students kind of expressing concern, like how do you navigate that?
Yeah, definitely. And they are also, we think there needs to be a prioritization of students' mental health being kind of out on the front lines of the protest. I've had people, you know, break down, they've walked by and they've started crying, really personal things where they've confided in me that, you know what, they had an abortion like a month ago, they were assaulted, really difficult stories where they're on campus trying to be in this academic headspace where university life is already stressful and it's tough, but especially for young people who have had to undergo experiences with maybe any reproductive trauma, whether they've had abortions or not, it's just not something that I think is acceptable to show to students.
Right. So UBC Lifeline, on their Facebook page where I found this, it says that they seek to promote open and fair discussion regarding the life issues and support individuals in making life-affirming decisions. Do you think that that has been demonstrated in the protests so far?
Not necessarily. I think the way they actually go about their protests really shows a lot of hypocrisy, where they're very keen to stand in front of these graphic images. But going through their Facebook as well, I actually haven't found any events of, hey, let's do fundraisers for foster children. Let's fund cheap, accessible contraceptives for all people. Let's talk to students about sexual education and maybe prevent pregnancies. They kind of go about it in a way that attacks people who have made a choice or shames people into making a certain choice out of a lot of guilt. So it's absolutely everyone's own choice, you know, if they want to be pro-life or pro-choice. But the way that they push that upon others doesn't necessarily provoke conversation. Mm-hmm. They are standing, you know, in front of those pictures talking to people, but it promotes a lot of confrontation where people see those pictures and they're not going up for an open discussion and debate on kind of this level ground to start off on. It's very emotionally charged, and that's what they are going off of, is using these very emotionally charged images to start their conversation and using it to talk about what is moral, right? If you see gore, is that moral? Well, we could talk about the same thing with a photo of childbirth, right? Mm-hmm. Lots of people wouldn't want that displayed on campus. So where do you draw the line with that and their tactics towards discussion?
Right, so it's all about sort of having heated discussions, but like, where does that go? What are they really doing outside of these few days that they're doing these protests?
Yeah, exactly. Because Lifeline, I wouldn't say they're a very visible club other than the few days of protest that they come out a couple of times a year. Not that I necessarily mind that they're not super visible, but what else are they necessarily doing to improve conditions for children that are born, right? What are they doing to maybe prevent abortions other than these super confrontational tactics that are very, very public?
Right. So just a question. If you could say something to someone from the UBC Lifeline, maybe in the context of the protest or maybe outside the context of the protest, whatever you choose, and if you could say something to them completely uninterrupted, what might you want to say to that person?
I'd want them to really look at themselves and look at what you're attaching your face to and if you're really doing any benefit for your community. Are you really saving lives, and whose lives are you prioritizing? You know, we all should have access to safe and affordable health care. But if you're prioritizing a fetus over a person who has become pregnant, what does that really say about your values? And what are you actually going to do to make people stop having abortions other than these super confrontational tactics? Would you ever be willing to raise money for people to have cheap contraceptives? Would you go out into the community and teach sexual education? Because it's been proven that abstinence-only states that have that kind of sexual education have higher rates of abortion. Are you really educated on the topic? You know, have you done research on what prevents abortion? And do you know that your posters don't?
Oh, yeah, actually, some of the discourses around the pictures themselves, I've heard folks saying, like, medically inaccurate photos. And so would that be something that you would want to address?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the one that sticks in my head is the abortion that occurred at 24 weeks. They have a photo up there. And for me, looking at the numbers, 90% of abortions occur before that 20-week mark. So a 24-week abortion is not only very rare, but it's very likely that there's something wrong with the fetus, or it could be endangering the mother's life, or, you know, no one wants to have an abortion that late because it's very traumatizing to the body. So if they did not have accessibility to a clinic where they could get that done, or if they simply did not know, they weren't educated on reproduction, that could happen. Like I've said before, abortion is never something that someone wants to go through, and hopefully they never have to go through it if they're provided good education and contraceptives. But if it does get to that point, you know, we should be looking at what are the sociological aspects to it. So when you post this photo saying, oh, there's this 24-week fetus that's been aborted without any of that context, that it's very rare to have an abortion that late, and there are these very specific circumstances that may lead to it, you know, you're kind of leading people astray in what's actually correct about abortion.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that folks can do to support GRSJUA in this situation, or anything that folks can do to support the folks who are impacted by this triggering content?
I would definitely say provide support for your friends, be there for other people on campus, and have your voice heard, right? If you don't like what you're seeing on campus, no matter what it is, we live in a society that's so great, like Canada, where we have this free speech, right? Lifeline utilizes it. Why don't you, right? Talk about Lifeline, write an article, go on the radio, do whatever you want to do to put your voice out there and say, you know what? I support you. If you've had to go through an experience like an abortion, I support your ability to make reproductive choices as an adult or just as someone who's had the circumstance where you've been pushed into that. You have your own right to your body, and I think that we should fully support all people who've had abortions or who need any support after seeing those images on their campus. So with GRSJ, you know, we have events throughout the year, and one of the things we do is collect donations for various organizations around Canada. At Chatting Over Chocolates, we collected some money for the Women's Memorial March on Valentine's Day. So looking into donating to causes like that, which will actually save lives and maybe recognize how unequal a lot of harm is in Canada.
Mm-hmm. So actually my last question, you kind of touched on this in the beginning already, was just wondering what's sort of on the horizon for GRSJ. Is there anything immediate coming up that you want to talk about, or maybe expand more sort of on the F-Word conference is what it's called, right?
Yeah. So the next one event that we would have coming up is mid-November, and that's what to do with your GRSJ major or minor. So we're bringing in graduates from the program who have applied GRSJ into their field of study. So I know for lots of students, they don't necessarily know where their degree is taking them. They're just studying what they're passionate in and where their heart is taking them. So it's very interesting to see people that have turned their passion into a lot of potential. And then the F-Word conference comes up at the end of second semester every year. So this year, planning is obviously still a ways away, but it's super exciting to know that we're going to, again, have a free conference for anyone who wants to attend, have opportunities for students to present their work on anything and everything related to GRSJ, whether or not they're in the faculty, and also provide workshops. So last year we had a few great ones like promoting trans literacies, where we talk about pronouns, what you should do in certain situations, dealing with non-binary genders and understanding how you can make non-binary people more comfortable in your community. We brought in Black Lives Matter to discuss police and pride and basically their position on that, what action has been taken and the history to that entire debate. A self-defense workshop, which is always very popular, and some other really great discussions take place around race, how we look at race, gender, you know, how this sort of thing has evolved and where conversations are taking us and where we hope to be in the future.
Great. Yeah. Wow. That's a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Really, yeah, of
appreciate
course.
It.
Given the current political climate and the rising circulation of white supremacist, cis, heteropatriarchy discourse, platforms that extend feminist, critical race, trans, queer, and indigenous scholarship are essential to understanding the global contemporary political, geographic, and social climate. Ignite is a social justice undergraduate academic journal that is now taking submissions for its eighth volume titled Illuminating Discourse. This issue is inspired by Toni Morrison and will touch on intersectional experiences that affect how we navigate the world. They are accepting academic essays between 10 to 15 pages with MLA format. Email your submissions to igniteubc@hotmail.com by March 1st to be considered.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news, as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
And we are back here on Intersections on CITR 101.9 FM and online at CITR.ca. It is 24 hours of student power. We are in the 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. hour of that. Do you do the math of how many hours it's been? It's been a lot. It's been a lot of rad student radio happening over the airwaves, over the internet waves, over your earwaves. It's been a lot of fun making it. Today on Intersections' special contribution to the 24 hours, if you will, we are featuring interviews produced by our student volunteers with other students here at UBC. We've already heard from Hannah talking about the vagina monologues with some of the cast and crew, and that was just Sam talking with members from the Gender, Race, and Sexuality and Social Justice Undergraduate Association, and that interview was originally aired back in October. And to finish off the show today, we're going to hear one more interview, and this one is one I'm particularly excited about just because it's fun to say out loud. It is about gender equity and ultimate frisbee. And that was produced by one of our great volunteers, Addison, back at the end of November of last semester. And it's with a really cool student who's doing a cool kind of entrepreneurial project looking to promote more gender equity for women and non-binary people in the ultimate frisbee scene. So that's pretty cool. So we're going to leave you with that as we go. Starting at 3 p.m., the UBC CVC will be in the booth on the airwaves and over. And make sure to stay tuned. In a couple hours, we're going to have some great live music happening for the conclusion of the 24 hours of student power. Though, let's be real, student power never stops. Power to the people, all that. If you're a student, you can be empowered anytime. You don't need radio people like me telling you to do it. Just go and do it yourself. That's what I say. But yeah, we're going to listen to Addison's interview right now. This has been Intersections. Again, UBC CVC will be up at 3 p.m. So enjoy that and happy Friday. Happy reading week, everyone. Enjoy.
Hello, everyone. My name is Addison from the Gender Empowerment Collective, and I'm here today with Laurel Oldershaw to talk about two really rad things. We're going to talk about gender equity, and we're going to talk about Ultimate Frisbee. Welcome to the studio today, Laurel. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So we're going to do a little introduction. If you could tell us who you are, what you do, what's your life.
Cool. My name is Laurel Oldershaw. I use she, her pronouns. I'm born and raised in Berkeley, California. Went out to school on the East Coast in the States, and I'm now out here at UBC for my MBA.
Cool. And I heard you just about finished up that program.
Yeah, this is our last week of project, so I'm very excited.
Sweet. Congrats.
Thank you.
So can you tell us a bit about about Ultimate and about Upwind? So if you can tell us about the sport and the community of Ultimate Frisbee, and then also what is the company Upwind Ultimate?
Definitely. So to start with Ultimate Frisbee, it's this crazy sport. You use a little plastic disc. You have 7-on-7 on essentially a football or soccer field, a little bit narrower. And it's essentially glorified keep away. So if I'm on offense, I want to make sure I only pass to my teammates, and we're going to score by catching the disc in the end zone. And similarly, if we drop it and the defense gets a turn, then defense becomes offense, and they start playing. They start going the other way. You play to points rather than time, so it's a little different, and it's also self-officiated, which means you make your own calls. So if we're playing against each other, and I think that you fouled me, it's technically a non-contact sport, and if I think that you had contact, then I can call foul, and you have the option to contest or no contest. So essentially to disagree with my call, contest, or agree with the call, no contest, and then depending on the rule, the play resets and we continue on. So it's got that cool aspect to it. Upwind Ultimate is a company that I founded to increase the value of women in Ultimate. So right now in the Ultimate Frisbee landscape, we see, particularly in the U.S., where most of Ultimate, I wouldn't say most of Ultimate is played, but where kind of the most public elite Ultimate is right now in the world, and the most publicized. And there's used to be two professional leagues, the AUDL, the American Ultimate Disc League, and the MLU, Major League Ultimate. And the MLU actually folded this last December, so in 2016. And the AUDL is going into their seventh year. And both leagues have just been men's leagues. One exception of Jesse Schaffner from Nashville, playing with Nashville Nightwatch. So Ultimate Frisbee right now for people who play is primarily for, it's primarily pay to play. So I play on a summer team and I'm paying all of my fees to compete. I'm paying all of my fees for practice space. I'm paying all of my fees to travel to compete, as well as all of my fees to feed myself when I'm competing, which is, as you know, a significantly more amount for athletes out there. For, you know, non-athletes, we're just burning a ton more calories. And if you want to excel, then, you know, there's higher priced foods and more nutritional based options that do show benefits in performance that, you know, are enticing for athletes, and especially people who want to be really competitive top athletes. So that all adds up to about $2,500 on average per player per summer. The AUDL provides that opportunity for men to play at no cost. So they get about 16 games in, they get flown to these games, they get housed at these games, they get food at these games, they get free jerseys. So, and most of them are getting paid. Some teams are claiming that they're not paying because at the moment the AUDL is losing money. But if you just take that look at how much they're getting free compared to how much women in the sport are having to play just to even get to that same, or just to even have access to that same level of competition, it's a huge imbalance. So Upwind Ultimate actually started a couple years ago from a question I had of what would it take to create a women's pro league. That led me to my MBA. It led me to creating something called the National Ultimate League, which started off kind of as that question of let's just, you know, have a league that really centers women. And there was a little bit of a pushback from there. And so we kind of took a step back, rebranded to Upwind, recentered to this mission of increasing the value of women in Ultimate, and really taking a dive into gender equity. I will say on that note that one of the things we try to be very vigilant about is having gender equity not be so centered on the experience of white women and white feminism. We have a tendency, I'm personally white myself and very queer, to kind of hone in on what my imbalances are rather than what's actually happening in society. And we, you know, we have this idea of the 77 cents to the dollar comparison between women and men and what they make in business. And that's just for white women, right? Then you start to go to black women at 67%. Hispanic women, it goes even lower to 63%. And that's, so there's just such a wide range of what we're looking at. And when I say to increase the value of women in Ultimate, it's this idea to take a look at women as a whole, as well as trying to expand that spectrum. So I believe the future is non-binary, and, you know, that's language that we haven't yet developed yet in the sports sphere, because the sports sphere is so binary. So it's hard to kind of promote that out there. But also, you know, one of the really big things we're taking into consideration when we say gender equity from Upwind's perspective is how intersectional are we being in race, class, ableism, gender identity, and as well as how are we making sure that the words we're using aren't then putting people into this box of womanhood, even though that's kind of what we're trying to promote. So it's a business that I'd like to say, you know, our big thing is safety, growth, and accountability, and continually reflecting on that.
Yeah, that's really great. Thank you for that, Laurel. So would you say part of what you talked about were a few of the key goals of your company, Upwind Ultimate?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, going back to, like, my dreams of a women's pro league or a pro league that doesn't just center around cis men is to really look at this dynamic opportunity to be had at the pro league level. So the thing about the sports economics, or the thing about sports economics in the sports entertainment industry, is that it's not so much what happens on the field, it's how we consume it. So the culture of sports really comes from this masculine, misogynistic perspective, you know, centers around men on the fields, really safe for men in the crowds, really safe for men watching in bars, not always safe for women and trans people and gender non-binary people. And so to me, and I don't know if this is specifically the goal of Upwind, but my personal goal is to open up that culture, that sports culture, so that everybody feels safe to be a part of it. Upwind right now is taking that on by focusing on the education aspect. So we're offering online courses The first one is called Understanding Whiteness. We're going to have some more courses in the spring around white feminism, around being trans and trans experience in sports and how do we expand there, as well as some very basic things of how do you create more equity on a mixed field. One of the cool things about Ultimate is we do have a mixed gender version of the sport, so it's in three divisions right now, men's, women's, and mixed. In that mixed gender, we still, though, out of the seven people on the field, tend to see an imbalance of four men versus three women. And so that's another thing that we're looking at.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And you were, with that, highlighting the gender binary. So with the three divisions, you have a binary of women, men, and then in the mixed one, designated as women and men as well. So I was curious, something that I see you often do that you did just now when you introduced yourself in the beginning of our talk, and then also what I see you do on the field, if you're leading or coaching or just a player as well, is you ask folks to introduce themselves with their gender pronouns. So I'm wondering, what does a practice like that aspire to do within the Ultimate community as far as the gender binary?
Yeah, I think it just breaks down assumptions, right? You know, everybody deserves to be called by the pronouns they want to use. And for the most part, I would say those match our assumed images for people. However, that's not 100% true across the board. And I think as we begin to see a future that is non-binary, that'll become less and less true across the board. And one of the interesting things about doing this in practices and through interviews is that the majority of the people I talk to, I would say almost 90%, don't actually know, they haven't heard pronouns before. So they're kind of like, female, gender, I don't know so much. And because of that, it's just kind of been an interesting practice to say, hey, this is something that people care about. It can open up the space for a lot of different people out there. And, you know, it's a very small thing. And I think it also just makes people reflect on their pronouns. Pronouns have so much weight, right? If you want to use they, it's kind of weird for a lot of people because it's new. And that kind of tends to make people uncomfortable. And that's something we just have to watch for. Particularly, I mean, language is huge. So it just kind of adds to creating more safer language that really opens up spaces.
Mm-hmm, definitely. I think your note on language is really important and how that's used to disrupt normalized and status quo of gender binary. So just taking the moment for people to be a little uncomfortable to make space for others that are not typically given that comfort and safety is really important.
Yeah. I will say one thing that I've seen the VUL, Vancouver Ultimate League, do, and I think the policy is similar, mm-hmm. is that it's not so much four men, four women, but four of one gender and three of another gender.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, is still not entirely what we're going for when we want it to be completely open based on gender. And I've talked to Jenna Weiner about this a little bit. She's an incredible activist, trans woman out of Reno. And she suggested this rule of doing 3-3 floater. So you have three of one gender, three of another gender, and one floater. And for the most part, the floater can be whoever. And then the genders are pretty much the same. And one thing, too, that hasn't yet been explored in the mixed division at most levels is that we still feel constricted to mark the people of our same gender rather than pushing ourselves or being open to marking different genders and just kind of like seeing what they would do. This actually just happened at a Team Canada U24 mixed game. We had a scrimmage between old Team Canada players from the world's levels, the adult levels playing against these juniors. And a woman marked up against a U24 guy, and he just kind of froze because it never happened to him before. And so it's kind of, there's little things like that that I think can really push us beyond this idea of gender binary and more into, okay, we're just all here to play sports. But it's that initial discomfort and reaction that's still, you know, we're still really working through that as a society and as a sport.
Mm-hmm, definitely. So we kind of talked a lot about the work that has to be done yet in the community, and not just in Ultimate, but that is part of the societal complex of gender inequity. And so what's something that you're hopeful or aspirational for, or what's your favorite nugget of Ultimate that you see a lot of hope in, that you really enjoy as a player, as an activist, as a coach?
Yeah, I would say not so much a nugget of hope, but a very interesting road to follow or group to follow would be those top levels. So I think the first thing, and for me and for everybody out there, is to go to Ultimate Canada and read that trans policy and compare that to USA Ultimate's trans policy and compare that to UK Ultimate's trans policy. Another thing that I've been recently hooked up to is talking to Athlete Ally, which is an organization in the U.S., a nonprofit that encourages every athlete to be an activist. I think that particularly we can all be activists and allies in creating a more open space for everyone, no matter their sexuality, no matter their gender.
Yeah, and all the intersections in between.
And all the intersections in between. It's actually, to me, that's the most interesting part of my job. And I learn something new every day about it because, like, if we just stay with what we know, we're never going to be able to grow. We're never going to be able to actually push ourselves somewhere forward in our policies, in our habits, in the way that we support more people without including all of the intersections. We're missing something. There's actually, I don't know if you've seen it,